Welcome to the Spotlight Edition of the Future of Medicine podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Wright. Join me as I have conversations with some of my favorite medical experts discussing a variety of common health questions. I hope you find this useful, empowering you with confidence along your journey toward optimal health. Let's jump right in. On this Spotlight Edition of the Future of Medicine podcast, I'm excited to be joined by Dr. James Earls of Clearly Health. Dr. Earls is a leader in the field of radiology, specifically working to strengthen the field of advanced cardiovascular imaging. Dr. Earls received his undergraduate degree in chemical engineering from the University of Massachusetts before receiving his medical education from the New York University School of Medicine. He completed his residency at Walter Reed Army Medical Center and then received fellowship training in body and cardiovascular MRI at NYU School of Medicine. Prior to working with Clearly, he served as Vice Chairman of Radiology at George Washington University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. He previously served as Medical Director and Vice President at Fairfax Radiological Consultants in Fairfax, Virginia. There, he was recognized as being an early innovator and clinical adopter of coronary CT angiography. At this point in his career, he has authored over 200 publications, primarily focused on advanced imaging technologies. Now a professor of radiology and working with Clearly Health, today he'll provide valuable insight into the role Clearly Diagnostics can play in creating well-informed and individualized care plans for countless patients. Dr. Earls, thank you so much for joining me on this Spotlight Edition. As you and I have chatted before, our practice at Brentwood MD really enjoys using Clearly technology to advance our members' care and be very proactive in their personalized health plans. And I'm just so excited to talk to you today and learn even more. So thank you for your time today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's an honor to be on. And this is obviously a topic that's near and dear to my heart. So I'm more than happy to share with you, and I'm excited about our conversation.
Absolutely. Well, to introduce you to our members and our general audience, I did want to ask just a little bit about what led you originally into the field of radiology, and then maybe what inspired this special interest now you have working with Clearly in the advanced cardiovascular imaging.
Sure. Well, you know, when I went to medical school, I had been an engineer as an undergrad, and I gravitated to imaging, I think, primarily because I was able to understand a lot of the physics and other things behind imaging. And I felt that was a way that I could use, things I had learned in the past to directly help people. By understanding CT and MRI and other modalities, you can actually make the best out of imaging. And so I was very interested in pursuing a career in radiology. I then wound up doing fellowship training in MRI. At the time, we all thought MRI was going to be the next most important way for doing cardiac imaging. Unfortunately, that never really panned out, but my interest there a few years later, when CT came along, the ability to do cardiac imaging, I really jumped on that and was an early adopter of coronary CT technology back in the early 2000s. And have been doing it and researching it and promoting it and doing it clinically for the last 20 years or so.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, we'll kind of dive into even the comparison between the MRI imaging and the CT angiography during this conversation. So anxious to get your thoughts. As we start, I want to really give a general question to you that doesn't even have as much to do with the details of the imaging, but from all of your experience and the things you're learning through these Clearly studies and such, what's maybe one or two things that you feel like you'd like to share to our listeners that they should do maybe differently for their cardiovascular health? What do you feel like may be most important from the things that you're seeing in your studies?
You know, I think an important issue today is it's not that we don't have good tools in the toolbox. You know, there's a lot of medications that have come out in the last few years that can be very effective at lowering patients' risk. The issue has been patient selection. You know, we don't really know who to use it on, but if we have these medications and we apply them in the right people, in the right amounts, we can substantially reduce cardiac events. And so I think the issue out today is, well, what is the correct way to select a patient? And we've all traditionally used risk factors that work well in big populations, but when you look at any individual patient, sometimes they just don't work as well. So I think this is trying to find a tool that works and then connects the patient with appropriate therapy, I think the place where we are right now in cardiac imaging and cardiac prevention is let's get these two together. The patient who is at risk with the medications that we have available, which we know work very well, and put the two together.
That's great. Well, and that's exactly where I want to take the next part of our conversation, is in the patient selection process. And when I came out of my training in family medicine a little over a decade ago, a calcium score was so vital and useful to the population and seemed to give kind of a glimpse into what the current state of one's cardiovascular health looked like. Tell me, how clearly was developed to really take that information to the next level and really do a little compare and contrast for me in the value of a calcium score versus the value of the information you can get from a Clearly report?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. So, 10 or 20 years ago, the only thing that we could really get in the coronary arteries was the calcium, right? So the calcium is a little bit easier to image than the non-calcified plaque. So we have, plaque breaks down into a couple of different components, calcified and non-calcified. So early on, back in the 80s, they actually developed technology to get a calcium score. And then lots of research, hundreds of thousands of patients have been evaluated with calcium scores. The problem, ironically, is the calcified plaque is not the bad plaque. I always think of calcium as being the scar of the plaque. It's your body has sort of tried to clean up the plaque that's there, and the calcified plaque is the end result. It's relatively benign histologically or physiologically. Calcium doesn't rupture. It doesn't, cause acute events, etc. But usually when you have calcium, you also have non-calcified plaque, or you also have low attenuation plaque, which is the type of non-calcified plaque that has the most risk. So in general, when calcium goes up, the other plaque goes up, and then events go up because, it's the other plaque, the non-calcified plaque, that correlates with events. So calcium scoring was usually considered to be, very predictive or prognostic of future events, because people who had more calcium also happen to have more non-calcified plaque or low attenuation plaque. So as the technology evolved, however, we went from only being able to detect the calcified plaque to now being able to detect all of the plaque. So we can detect the calcified plaque, the non-calcified plaque, and the low attenuation plaque. And it's, in fact, those last two plaques, which are the plaques that can cause acute events, can cause blockages, can cause ischemia, which is where there's lack of blood flow to the heart muscle. So as the technology has evolved, we can be much more specific about what type of plaque that we image. And the reason it's important now to look at the non-calcified plaque is that we certainly have lots of cases where, especially in people in their 40s and 50s, where they may not have any calcified plaque. So in that situation, a calcium score of zero would give you the false impression that you actually don't have atherosclerosis. But in fact, many of those people just have non-calcified plaque. As plaque gets older, as we get older, it evolves and starts to calcify. But the lack of calcium certainly does not equal lack of risk of a coronary event. As a matter of fact, our data shows that if you take all people who have a coronary event, acute coronary syndrome, and an MI, one third of those actually have calcium scores of zero. So that's why we're evolving away from relying solely on calcium to a more comprehensive view of let's look at all the plaque and determine all of the risk, rather than relying on one sort of injury. Even though it's a direct marker of atherosclerosis, it doesn't show the whole picture.
Thank you. That's a great review. I once had a cardiologist friend of mine, an interventional cardiology friend of mine. He used the term rocks don't rupture right, when he was kind of describing the calcium. And like you said, the fact that it doesn't rupture, it does not lead to the actual events that you may see. And I even tell my patients that it is, in a way, it's your body's healing from the plaque that it's seen. It is its body, the body's attempt to stabilize and control that plaque burden. But you don't want to just limit your information to that number. You want to be looking, and especially like you mentioned, in a younger population, you know, what kind of foundation is being laid of the soft plaque?
Oh, absolutely. And we see soft plaque in, you know, we've certainly seen it in people in their 20s and 30s. You can have soft plaque for 10 or 20 years before it starts to calcify. You know, the way that many people live and the diet that we eat and maybe some of the genetic risk factors we have, you know, atherosclerosis is a disease that begins early in life. Fortunately, usually doesn't start to cause symptoms until many years later, but it is a very progressive, process that starts early in our lives. So, you know, you can have people, as you say, who have no calcium, but still are at relatively substantial risk at younger ages. Not that I'm advocating imaging people at that point or that young in age, but, you know, that is a point where the disease process does start. So at some point, optimally, you know, checking in and seeing where you are, especially if you have, you know, more risk factors, I think becomes, you know, the risk-benefit ratio turns positive, right? You'll benefit from knowing what you have and getting appropriate therapy. Even though there are some risks of a CT, you know, there's a small amount of radiation involved and some medications are used, but the benefit, of course, of reducing, future events and knowing your risk, I think, outweighs some of those smaller, the theoretical risks of the radiation or medications from the scan.
Yes, absolutely. Well said. Well said. Now, you were just touching on the plaque and the differences between non-calcified and calcified. Kind of from a 10,000 foot view, tell me how that clearly takes those CT angiogram images and is able to determine what's calcified, what is non-calcified, and even more so the low density non-calcified, which to my understanding is a little more volatile and a little more at higher risk for rupture.
Yeah, sure. So on a CT scan, the atherosclerotic plaque has a whole spectrum of appearance. It can be, as we've been saying, it can be calcified. It can be non-calcified and have sort of a fibrous consistency, or it can be low attenuation. That usually is a plaque that has a high cholesterol concentration, right? So the cholesterol and triglycerides actually can be concentrated within the plaque and form a liquid pool of within the plaque. And that's the stuff that actually, if a plaque ruptures, meaning the covering ruptures and that liquid cholesterol is exposed to the blood, that's where you get a clot may form and propagate. That's where you get an acute coronary syndrome. You know, someone develops chest pain and keels over, you know, that's often, not always, sometimes it's an arrhythmia, but often that may be a plaque rupture and an acute ischemic event. And then the heart may, respond to it in different ways. So again, we see this sort of spectrum of different types of plaque. And we know that low attenuation plaque that contains the liquid cholesterol and other things, has been correlated to have the highest risk of having an event. So it's a spectrum of risk. And then fortunately for us on CT, it's a spectrum of what we call density. So the riskiest plaque on CT is very dark, has what's called a low Hounsfield unit associated with it. The non-calcified plaque, which is in the middle, it has a lower risk, and then it has a medium density on the CT. And then the calcified plaque, which as we've been talking about, is benign, is the brightest. So on the CT scan, a human, as me as a reader, you know, we can see the plaque. So we can tell that the plaque is there. The problem is that human readers are not able to look at this sort of tree of all these vessels and add up how much plaque there is and come up with a quantitative measure of the plaque. I couldn't look at a scan and say there's 250 units of plaque or 169 units or 300 units. But the AI is able to do, you know, very tedious things very reproducibly and very accurately. So that's where the AI is able to, you know, do something that as humans we just can't do as well, and it can do it very reproducibly and in a quantitative manner. So it can precisely look at all of the arteries, determine where all the plaque, as well as the narrowings that we call stenosis, and, you know, add it up and then, you know, generate a report, which, you know, the physician can look at and then precisely know exactly how much and what type of plaque a patient has so they can determine therapy.
That's great. Oh, and thank you for even explaining a bit of how a myocardial infarction occurs and how that's related to the plaque, and the density may give you a glimpse into how likely a rupture could occur in that area. I often, when I'm reviewing a CLEARLY report with my members, they often ask, you know, what's the least narrow artery that has yielded a heart attack? You know, because as you know, when and as we walk through the CLEARLY report and we look through all the major coronary vessels, and you'll get varying levels of stenosis or that narrowing in certain vessels, you know, you're always hopeful for very minimal stenosis, but sometimes you'll see 10, 15, 20% or more. But from your experience and knowledge, what's maybe the least narrow, the most, I guess the, a better way to word it, the most open vessel that has yielded a myocardial infarction before?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, it's a great question, because I think probably, definitely when I was in training, and even perhaps when you're in training, you know, we would conflate stenosis with risk. You know, we thought that if someone didn't have any stenosis, they had no risk. And if they had a high degree of stenosis, they were at high risk. But in fact, the two are really not as closely related as you think. So there's a study called the ICONIC trial that looked at several hundred people who actually had an MI. And these are people who previously have had a CT. So they went back and looked at the CT in the precise location where they had a plaque rupture. And what they learned was the vast majority of those plaques that ruptured, up to 75 or 80% of them, were actually in lesions that were not obstructing. They were less than 50%, sometimes less than 25%. So it really sort of changed this whole concept of stenosis and risk of an event. You know, the risk is due to the amount of plaque that's there. And you can have a lot of plaque and no stenosis or very little stenosis. But as you get more plaque, you generally get more stenoses. And so, you know, higher grade stenosis usually means there's more plaque too. So they are related, but not, you know, directly related to, you know, the fact that, you know, we only see a plaque ruptures in high grade stenosis. We definitely see them in people with very mild stenosis, even less than 25%. We see people with events. So that's, I think about 40% of events occur in people who have stenoses of less than 25%, at least from a recent paper in atherosclerosis, which is one of our journals. So I don't want to scare people they're not always directly related. So even if you don't have a stenosis, it's actually your plaque volume is a more important consideration than actually the stenoses that may be present.
Yes. No, thank you for clarifying that. And like you said, not to scare people, but really just to educate and to identify truth in what the origin story of both atherosclerosis, but also in a myocardial infarction would be. And I think to speak from kind of a patient perspective, it's so easy to latch on to that stenosis. You know, we've all told stories of family members or others in our community with, you know, oh, they had a bypass, they had a 95% blockage, and it does, and it is so impressive. And you latch on to those numbers and you latch on to the blockage. But in reality, like you said, the plaque volume might and is more indicative of that risk, both in the short term, but also in the chronic process of atherosclerosis.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I go over, as you do, a lot of analyses with patients, you know, and when someone does get a study, of course, everybody wants to see that their study has no plaque or very little plaque. Of course, we all love to have a good result and to show our patients that it's a good result. But even when patients see a lot of plaque and have a lot of disease on their study, it really is good news, right? Because nothing bad has happened to them, right? And now mm-hmm. they have this opportunity to work on this plaque and stop its progression and transform it into a more benign phenotype. So, you know, I always try to, you know, reassure them that nothing has happened, you know, probably nothing's going to happen in the near future, but you now have this opportunity to substantially reduce your risk of a future event. So it's sort of like a gift that you're given, this knowledge of, hey, you're at elevated risk, but we have things that we can do about it, and we can reduce your risk before anything bad has happened. So that I really try to reassure patients in that manner.
Absolutely. You know, and I guess it's kind of cultural in a way, but I think it's just human nature that a picture is worth a thousand words. And needless to say, ever since I was in medical school and almost every day beyond, I've been talking about cholesterol levels, been talking about blood sugar, A1C levels, and blood pressure. And those can often seem to patients very two-dimensional. You know, they just have their number and then they have the reference range. But I tell you, in the last year and a half that I've been working with Clearly reports from CTA imaging, it really brings to life those levels, those risk factors. And that actually is what I'd love to hear your input on, is how you've seen Clearly results and really individualized treatment plans. Like you started our conversation talking about patient selection and all the tools we have, and whether it's a specific case that you want to mention or just more general, how have you seen these results really advance an individualized care plan?
Yeah, well, I think the word is individual, right? I think we're talking precision medicine, right? Because if we're relying on cholesterol levels to determine someone's therapy, we all have examples of people who have terrible cholesterol levels, who have high ApoB and other markers, who actually have no or very little atherosclerosis. And we have people who have normal cholesterol levels who have a lot of disease, right? So it's relying on cholesterol and other indirect markers of the disease, because cholesterol is not the disease, right? Atherosclerosis is the disease. So they generally correlate with each other. But, you know, if you take 100 people, you can sort of reliably predict who's going to have it and who's going to not have it based on cholesterol or other markers. But any one person, you cannot be precise, because that person may have risk factors but no disease, or they may have no risk factors and a lot of disease. So I think what we see is that when, you know, a person, honestly, even as a physician, when I go see my physician, I'm always like, oh, what's my HDL supposed to be? And you know, what's this level and what's that level and what percentile and what are the guidelines? And it's honestly hard to keep up with it. But when I see a picture of my vessels and I can see plaque and stenosis there, then, you know, it's sort of unquestionable that you have this disease process. Yeah. And it's really not that hard to even determine whether it's mild or moderate or severe. So, you know, what we see with people when they do see that picture, you know, when you make that connection, was here's your disease, then this is how much you have, and now you have an opportunity. I think it's really motivating, and people will be more compliant, right? They're more likely to go home and fulfill that you know, prescription for statin, or keep filling it, you know, 3 or 6 or 12 months later, or, you know, make that lifestyle modification, you know, quitting smoking that they've been trying to do for a long time, or losing weight or exercising more regularly. I think when people see their images, it makes them more compliant. You know, they understand their disease much better than holding on to a couple of numbers that they really have no concept or to really understand the risk. But when you actually see it, you're like, okay, there it is. Now I need to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, even just with my small patient population, I have seen those examples you reference where I would have thought that the Clearly report would have looked 10 times worse than it actually did. And I've seen patients that I would have expected it to look, you know, the opposite, 10 times better than it actually did. And it makes for some good discussions and even some enjoyable ones when you're kind of pleasantly surprised, but then it also makes for some really challenging ones when the the individualized picture of one's heart does not match what you would have suspected their risk factors to lead to. So it's fascinating. It's been a game changer for us in our practice and in our primary care patients. So thankful for it.
Yeah. And, you know, as we started out saying, you know, we really, once, let's say you fall down on the side of having a lot of disease, you know, the good news is nowadays there's lots of medicines out there that are available. It's also been proven that, you know, even, you know, diet changes and lifestyle modifications can actually favorably affect the plaque too. You don't have to fully rely on medications. I mean, they certainly help, but we have lots of examples of people who didn't want to take a medication, but they get really serious about exercise. They get really serious about diet. And then, you know, they come back a year or two or three later and they can have actually substantially favorable changes in their plaque over time. So it really, you know, can be very empowering when someone actually comes back and takes a look a second time and says, hey, you know, all that was worth it, you know, getting up and going to the gym or, you know, no longer eating as much meat as I was before or whatever. And then to actually show is like, yeah, hey, you did make changes here. You reduced your own risk by this, you know, this decision that you made in your life to do the right thing.
Yes. No, definitely not to be overlooked at all. You know, I often talk to my patients about their foundations of their general health, being their nutrition, their exercise, their sleep, their stress management, and then relational and spiritual and mental health. And I think clearly has really brought about some discussions about those areas with a different lens, where that stress management may really need to be worked on, or maybe, you know, the annoyance of not sleeping well actually needs to be a priority number one, because it appears that that could be causing some damage. So, thank you for bringing that to light. The next place I want to shift to is in a newer technology, even within the Clearly Health offerings, and one that I know far less about, to be frank, because I have gotten really accustomed to the Clearly initial, I guess, the original type report. But now there's this Clearly Ischemia. Tell me about that and what information that draws, to my understanding, from the exact same images that are obtained for the original Clearly report, but now we have some details on blood flow and ischemic risk.
Yeah. So, you know, traditionally, you know, stress testing, which is something that we do for symptomatic patients, you know, stress testing is done when someone has symptoms. And the point of doing stress testing is to find a stenosis that may be a high grade stenosis, which doesn't allow enough blood flow to the heart muscle. So, you know, as the vessel narrows, you know, the ability for blood to get to the, you know, the coronary arteries themselves, what they do is they feed the heart muscle. You know, the heart is a bag of muscle and it pumps blood to, you know, around the body. But the muscle in the heart, just like the muscles in your legs or arms, need fresh blood and oxygen and glucose on a regular basis to function. So when people have a stenosis, usually during exercise or times of high cardiac output, you may not get enough blood flow to the muscle, and then metabolites build up and that can lead to chest pain. So that, you know, traditionally, if you are having symptoms, what the ischemia product does is it looks at all the arteries. It takes into account now, so now we are talking about blockages and higher degrees of blockages. It looks for all those. It looks at all the plaque, all the blockages, the size of the vessel, et cetera. And it makes a prediction or correlation with what an invasive marker of ischemia would be. So if you have a positive ischemia result, that means probably you have a stenosis, which would potentially benefit from being revascularized. And that means, you know, getting a stent put in, or if there's many of them, maybe getting bypass surgery. So we've moved away from the prevention world, which is what we were talking about before, now into treatment of people who actually have ischemic heart disease. And even in our prevention world, sometimes we do see people who may not be having symptoms currently, but they may have some high stenosis, some high areas of narrowing. So this is a way to evaluate those people to see if more traditional measures of intervention may be necessary because of the degree or the number of stenoses that they have.
Got it. And I wanted to revisit something you mentioned earlier, where you mentioned maybe MRI at one point kind of seemed to be a more leading technology, but that hasn't necessarily panned out. And with stress imaging, like you mentioned, stress testing, but also stress echocardiograms or stress MRIs, tell me what kind of information we'll get from a clearly ischemia and how it stands in comparison to the information you may get from one of those other modalities.
Yeah, we've recently had some publications where we compared our ability to detect ischemia on CT using clearly with the more traditional measure of stress testing. So the most common way that a stress test is done in the United States, about 70% of stress tests are using what's called nuclear medicine. So that you take a radioactive isotope, inject it in the body at rest, and it accumulates in the heart. You take a picture of it, and then you exercise the patient and you re-inject it again. And then you compare those two images. And if there's a defect on the stress image, then it infers that there's a blockage that may need to be revascularized. So when we compare our ability to detect ischemia with traditional nuclear medicine ability, we have higher accuracy, higher sensitivity, and much higher specificity. The problem with those nuclear stress tests, which again, there's about 8 or 10 million of them done every year in the United States, is they tend to be sensitive, but they're not very specific. And so they're low specificity. What happens, which a lot of people, they wind up going to the cath lab where potentially you could get a stent. But then when you're in the cath lab, it turns out you don't have a stenosis. And so that's why, in the United States currently, only about one out of every three people who goes to get this cardiac catheterization that costs, tens of thousands of dollars actually need to be there. So nuclear medicine is a poor gatekeeper to the cath lab. It sends too many people there needlessly. So if you use CT and then a clearly analysis, if you get to the cath lab, odds are you need to be there. There's a very low negative cath rate, meaning that you don't go there and then they determine that you don't need to be there. Almost everybody who gets there then actually winds up getting a stent or other or potentially a bypass if they have multiple blockages.
That's a great review. And I'll tell you, just from our community here in Nashville, I have heard many cardiologists echo that exact same thought, where the balance of the specificity and sensitivity is so well served through this technology. Now, as a primary care provider, how should I be thinking about when to generate that clearly ischemia report? Is there a threshold of stenosis, either in a single vessel or in multiple vessels, that I should then trigger my thought into the ischemia workup?
Yeah, it's actually a combination of symptoms and blockages, right? So if someone is symptomatic and symptoms, as you know, can sometimes you get classic chest pain, but other times it can can just manifest as decreased exercise tolerance and other things, and then not that the insurance companies of the world define what we do, but at least in terms of determining whether they'll pay for an ischemia study, because there is insurance coverage for that. Usually it's you need a stenosis of maybe 40 to 50% or higher, to get reimbursed for it. So, generally less than 50%, it's extremely unlikely that a stenosis is going to cause symptoms. Between 50 and say 70 or 75%, it may be a 50-50, chance that, if the patient's symptomatic and they have a stenosis in that range, about half of them turns out to be ischemic. And then above 70 to 80%, it's almost 100%. So it's really that it's most helpful in that intermediate range where there's sort of a 50-50 chance. We know less than 50%. It's not that it never happens, but it's rare. Above 70 to 80%, it's almost 100%. And then between those two, that's where the ischemia testing can really help you make a decision in that group.
Very good. So just to make sure I understand that well, you know, obviously symptoms change the story. So if there's any symptoms and there's a high level stenosis above 40, 50%, there's definite value. But in an asymptomatic patient, or the ones I run into often where they may have been slowly symptomatic, where their exercise tolerance, they may not notice a change, but it's also not normal for who they are and their age and such. Anything above 40 to 50 and the higher you go, the more likely you may see some abnormalities on the ischemia workup, even in an asymptomatic patient.
Yeah, precisely. Again, it's approved for use in symptomatic patients, but we do, you know, for the many people who do a CT now for prevention, who are, well, at least they believe they're asymptomatic, the problem is that sometimes we do encounter stenoses in this range, right? And so then everybody wants, well, is this a stenosis? Because I think this is where the art of medicine comes in, where you use your clinical judgment and experience. And someone who's not overtly complaining of symptoms, but once you start digging deeply, you find out, well, you know, I used to run a lot. Now I just walk because, you know, I can't run anymore. I just, because I'm getting old and my knees are going out. And sometimes, well, that actually is a way of getting symptoms. On our website, we have a man who's actually works in our quality department who had that exact story. He felt he was asymptomatic. He had clearly done a CT and clearly done just for prevention purposes. And he had a 95% stenosis of his LAD. He then wound up getting a stent. And then after his stent, he's like, I feel 20 years younger. Now I can go backpacking again. I can go doing all the stuff that I used to do that I stopped because I thought I was just getting old, but in fact, he stopped because he had ischemic heart disease and didn't know it. So, you know, probably an unusual case, but that's the problem is that sometimes defining symptoms is actually, can be hard on an individual basis.
Exactly. Well, I think it's a great point looking at kind of what the action item may be after the result of one of these tests. And so with the initial clearly we were discussion, it's very actionable in their lifestyle and their stress and their sleep, like we mentioned, but it's also actionable with the tools of medications. But then that's clearly ischemia. The action item there is, do they need intervention? Do they need stent?
Yes.
And so it's kind of, you want to make sure when you're ordering a test, you're ready for the result and that it's actionable. And the action results from both of these options are different. Useful in their own, you know, specific patients. Like you mentioned before, patient selection is crucial with both of these.
Yes. Yeah, certainly a large majority of people who come in for prevention, you know, don't have a stenosis. You know, we're probably less than, you know, 5 or 10% of people wind up having a stenosis, which is actionable. So the majority of patients don't get that news. But, you know, if you are that person, again, nothing bad has happened. Now you have information that is actionable and you can do something about it. So it's not necessarily a bad thing because you are probably, again, reducing your chances of either becoming symptomatic or having an event happen in the future. So, you know, again, we try to be always be a glass is half full people here that, you know, even a bad result is good because it's an opportunity to do something before something bad happens to you.
Well said. Well said. Well, as we wrap up today, I kind of want to give you the opportunity to share with us anything that you feel like may be on the horizon, either for clearly or for in the broader world of advanced imaging. I'd love to hear what we may be able to look forward to in the coming years and decades.
Yeah, well, it's an exciting time to be in the field because, you know, on the prevention side, there's a number of new medications that will be coming to market, you know, soon, treating coronary artery disease is a very complex disease because there's not a single cause of it, right? It's inflammatory, it's thrombotic, it's genetic, it's atherosclerotic, right? So we have a bunch of new medications coming on the market that will specifically target those components. So, you know, people will be able to get much more appropriate medication for what, you know, their disease process is. So we're very excited about that. On our side, we do have some new predictive analytics that are in the product pipeline. So rather than, the outputs that we give now, we'll be able to more precisely determine an individual patient's risk in sort of a quantitative way. And I think that'll be exciting and useful. We also are getting some nomograms for plaque, so that if you're a 52-year-old woman with, 150 units of plaque, we'll be able to precisely say that, 90% of women have a higher or lower amount of plaque than you do. So people will be able to, because 100 units of plaque in someone who's 40 years old is very different than 100 units of plaque in someone who's 70 years old, right? So putting it into sex and age normative ranges, I think, will be very helpful, both for patients to understand their disease as well as for providers trying to determine, what their therapy is. So those nomograms should be out later this year, and we'll certainly circulate those and make them available to you. These other medications, of course, that's not from our company, but, we know that they'll be available, intermittently over the next several years. And our toolbox, which is already pretty good, will be getting even better than it is now.
Yeah. How exciting. It's come so far. I mean, frankly, and this was partially due to my own ignorance, but 5 years ago, I would not have been familiar with this type of imaging, and it was just advancing, and now it's part of my daily routine and my practice. And it's exciting to think about how even the advanced routine we have now is just the tip of the iceberg, hopefully, for what comes in the future. So
absolutely, and you should be recognized as a really an early adopter and pioneer of doing this. This is still, medicine changes very slowly. It takes years and years, and pioneering people like you who understand the new technology and are able to incorporate it into your clinical practice really need to be commended, because lots of people sit back and they don't want to be the first, or even in the first half of people doing something. They wait till everybody else is doing it and they start doing it. And if everybody was like that, we would, we'd still be using leeches and, bloodletting to treat diseases. So, you should be commended for embracing what you're doing and promoting it, because you are absolutely saving lives on a daily basis.
Well, thank you. And it has been so valuable to our individualized care plans for our patients. It's just been so wonderful. So, Dr. Earls, thank you for your time today. I've really enjoyed this conversation, a lot of great depth and information. And so thank you for your time. And we look forward to continuing to work with Clearly moving forward.
Well, thank you for having me. And thanks so much, for your commitment to your patients and to using us to improve their health.
Absolutely. Have a great day.
All right. Thank you.
I want to thank you for listening to this conversation. I truly hope you found it useful. You can find out more about today's episode and discover additional content at BrentwoodMD.com/podcast. If you haven't subscribed, please do so. We would be honored if you would leave a review or even a recommendation for a future conversation you would like to hear. If you would like to learn more about the concierge services that we provide at BrentwoodMD, email us at membership@BrentwoodMD.com. We'd love to meet you. This podcast was for general information only and does not constitute the practice of medicine or giving of medical advice, as no doctor-patient relationship has been formed. The content of this podcast is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Listeners should seek the advice of their own trusted medical professionals.